very little point in coming in second, which meant that we could do things with pretty simple equipment in the early days. We had the advantage of weather. I mean, winter or summer, one can work outside here. If you're in the Soviet Union, you can only lay concrete during 3 months of the year and that kind of thing. And there are the same difficulties in North America, even in Britain, and so on. So weather was on our side. And I think Taffy Bowen was on our side.
In terms of constantly supporting the effort?
In terms of letting people have their head, I think. And giving you a pat on the back when you did well and commiserating with you when something failed. I think he had an attitude which helped things along. And the other thing, of course, is there was complete openness at Radio Physics. People talked to each other about what they were doing and so on, which, you know, didn't happen in a place like Cambridge.
Even amongst the subgroups at Cambridge, you're saying?
Yes.
Are you saying then, well, I've gotten the impression that while there may have been an openness, there was a lot of isolation because of all these field sites and so forth.
Well, you asked for the very early days.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm asking over the whole period.
Over the whole period? I think one of the things is there was enough of us. And so, generally, somebody was on top. This was important, let's say, in the middle phase around 1950-55. Where you can have three or four groups who were building equipment for a couple of years, but one of them had got stuff coming out.
I see.
And so on from the outside, so it looked as always though radio physics was...
A lot of depth, in other words.
Yeah, so there was a lot of depth.
So you did not work here during the war.
No.
Most other people have commented on the outgrowth of the laboratory during the war and how this sort of set the style for rapid innovation and these sort of things. But that's not part of your background, of course.
No.
You didn't observe this to be an important influence, though?
Radio physics has not always been successful. I mean, I think at all stages, some of us have been very irritated with the lack of progress. But when you compare what happens in other organizations,
well, yes,
I mean, it's why the Germans lost the war. We were bloody inefficient, but they were even less efficient,
right.
And there are only really a couple of places in the world I've visited which had something of the same spirit of radio physics, and one is Bell Telephone Labs and the other is Lick Observatory. Well, Lick Observatory over the years has, you know, been much more successful than its massive counterpart a few hundred miles south. Bell Telephone Labs was always a very good organization. Well, it's not such a good organization now. It used to be in a lot of little huts with duck boards between for the bad weather and that kind of thing. The director took his turn each week in cutting up sandwiches one day a week and so on. But there, individuals were allowed to operate as individuals.
And, so you think that's a key element in any...
Yes, I think that's a key element. Of course, how one integrates it into a large machine like we've got now is... there are stages when this is pretty difficult, but we're now very much back to operating on an individual basis. Parks is set up so that the observatory is virtually autonomous.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it runs itself. Radio physics doesn't run it.
I still don't see what you mean. What would be the alternative to have? You've got to have somebody who selects who gets what time and what the overall...
Well, this is done by a committee. Who gets what time?
So by autonomous, do you mean sort of democratically run rather than fashion, or?
Yes, I mean the local staff here operate the telescope without interference from. There's not a great deal of interaction between
From Sydney.
From Sydney, I mean, Radio Physics is just one of the organisations which uses this telescope.
Well, in fact, that's true now. Yes.
Yes, it wasn't so true in the early days, but in the early days. We didn't have the support facilities here. There was me and there was John Shimmins and there was one mechanic and one electrician, and that was it. And so people had to do the things that the telescope was capable of doing. And but nowadays, of course, it's equipped with receivers which span the entire spectrum and offline press, on and offline processing equipment and everything like that. So if a program's feasible at all, you can get it on the Parkes telescope, whether you know anything about radio astronomy or not.
I mean, well, this, of course, has been something
about one quarter of our observers now come from optical observatories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the UK Schmidt people, the Anglo-Australian people, the British visitors who come out to the AAT and so on. They all get on the Parkes telescope. There's really lots of individuals using the telescope once more. This wasn't true in the early days, you see, when the scientists very largely, you couldn't use a 21 centimeter parametric amplifier unless you worked with the men who built the 21 centimeter parametric amplifier.
And you knew how to tune it and where the liquid hydrogen was.
Yeah, it was Frank Gardner, and what's more, you couldn't operate unless you worked with somebody who knew how to drive the telescope.
Hmm. Yeah, I think this has been a fundamental change in the science, which took place in the mid-60s somewhere.
I mean, we have evolved to this state where it was plump. I mean, it was, in the case of Greenbank, it was... people can't get still can't get their observations done for them as they do at Greenbank,
yeah.
But I think this...
Or Westerbork, of course, is the ultimate in this.
Westerbork is the ultimate in this,
yeah.
And...
But don't you think this was inevitable? I mean, I really don't. There are very few places where this is not the style of operation now, because of the extreme complexity of,
mm-hmm.
of large instruments.
You have to have the support. But still, the people who are capable of building their own equipment and their own telescope do a lot better than this. Yeah.
It's certainly a plus for them, but it's not a necessary thing.
No, it's not a necessary thing.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to comment on the overall history of radio astronomy up through the early 60s?
I don't think so, really.
We haven't really commented specifically on the whole log N, log S business and what radio sources are telling us about cosmology, but let's just end with that. Starting in your attitude in the 50s, it seems like it was clear to you that these Cambridge sources were not real. What about the Mills survey? Did you feel like that was giving a more reliable result?
Well, yes, more reliable, because it had it was synthesized pencil beam, which is just a little is one stage better than the confused interferometer state.
But you're implying still not as good as a filled aperture.
Oh no, I mean, nothing can be a filled aperture. But I mean, the whole log N, log S business is pretty well sorted out now. Everybody is in agreement as to what the log N, log S does. It goes up very slightly steeper than minus 1.5 and comes down and then eventually turns over. And depending on what frequency you're using, those effects are magnified or diminished to some extent.
But of course what has changed greatly is the general attitude towards its applicability to telling you something about the nature of the universe.
Mm. Well, as far as the nature of the universe is concerned, it all depends what you want to believe in. And if you are looking for something which parallels the birth and death of a human being, then you're going to find the birth and death of the universe. But that's not necessarily, it's very difficult to get away from this attitude,
in our Western culture, anyway.
The circumstances of one's environment. One lives in a biochemical, irreversible process world, and so on the large-scale physics of the universe, it's hard not to inflict your personal life history on that of the universe. But I don't know that's necessarily the way. I mean, Fritz Zwicky used to say, you know, look, you must look at the universe for what it has to tell you, not for what you want to find, because you always find what you want.
Right, but that's, of course, extremely difficult to do.
Yes, it's extremely difficult to do.
Sounds like you're a bit of not pessimist, but what's the word? Agnostic as far as cosmology goes.
Yes, because... and I mean, one is constantly forcibly struck by when I grew up in astronomy, the universe was a quiescent universe in which all the energy in the universe was represented in the thermonuclear processes which took place in the inside of stars, and apart from certain cataclysmic events. Ten to the tenth years was a sort of time scale on which things changed. Now, the universe has taken an awful beating since those days. Things change in milliseconds.
Right.
And the energy of the universe is by no means confined to the thermonuclear processes in stars. I mean, physics is a reversible thing, it's not an irreversible thing. Sure, in most cases radiation is downgraded, but then there are things like masers in which radiation is not being downgraded, and I don't think that we're by any means at the end of these things, so I think it's very naive to look for the births and deaths in the counts of radio sources. One of the curious things is that one doesn't find as much birth and death effect in the objects which are very much more distant. The flat spectrum quasars and so on show nothing like the steep log n log s radio galaxies do. Now this is very peculiar, you see, because you're looking back a lot further and I have a sort of vague integral theory that all one really has to do is just expand the universe and these things will happen naturally. And I think the key to this is the perhaps the relationship between interstellar and intergalactic densities that perhaps in the very early universe, I mean, just taking something which is expanding, intergalactic densities are the order of interstellar densities, so the confinement of the radio source is almost assured.
Yes.
Then as the universe expands, probably the galaxies don't scale, but the intergalactic material does scale, so you're left with a changing ratio of interstellar densities to intergalactic densities.
Mm-hmm.
What this means is that you now come upon two classes of objects, one in which the interstellar densities are high enough to confine a radio source, and one in which the interstellar densities are not high enough to confine a radio source, and once it is out in intergalactic space there is nothing to confine it, you see. And out of this one can put quite a nice scenario that, say, looking back to redshift 3 or something like that, everything is in the form where the interstellar density and the intergalactic densities are of the same order and one has confinement and you've only got small diameter sources. And as we get down to redshift half or something like that, one gets to the stage where elliptical and spiral galaxies are very different, and in the case of the spirals, one still has the interstellar density to confine the source, but in the elliptical galaxy, It's gone down, and so one produces the one produces an epoch of large diameter, high luminosity sources, and so on. Now, I mean, the last three graduate students I've had, for example, even though I have the attitude it doesn't necessarily say anything about the birth and death of the universe, have all ended up with something, the same thing. Yet Myrtle's thesis, which was on luminosity function for radio galaxies, simply says that, you know, if one interprets a redshift as cosmological, then some rather drastic evolution is required for the radio galaxies. And Jasper Wall on quasars came up with the same thing. Now then, Savage has come up with the same thing, even more so, on optical QSOs.
Mm-hmm. But now there seems to be a little bit of a contradiction, because you at first made the philosophical point that the answer you get depends on the question you ask.
Mm.
And then yet you were saying that in the past 30 years the universe has taken a real beating because of what's been observed, fast time changes, very energetic processes and so forth. Are you then saying that these things have been observed because these are only the things that we've looked for? You see what I'm getting at?
Well,
is it because,
I mean, this theorizing is always based on the belief that we know everything.
I don't follow that. You mean that you know everything that's of importance for the problem at hand that you're...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Something could be discovered tomorrow,
yes.
Which...
Yes. If one had some down-conversion process, which goes on in the transmission of radiation, this would get rid of the strange paradox of the flat spectrum source being not having a steeper log n log s. You see, the log n log s one gets is a the only real relation to anything I can find is the spectral index of the object. The steeper the spectral index of the object, the steeper the log n log s curve. And that's something which really nobody has explained. Now, it may be just that spectral index is an indicator of angle size, brightness temperature. Well, this idea of the non-scaling of the intergalactic medium fits in with that kind of explanation. But there may be some other explanation, you see.
So, in terms of back to pre-1960, from what you said, I would think that you would say that this was not premature to be making cosmological implications based on source counts, if you had some reasonably reliable source counts, and it's a process that's still going on today.
Yes, I mean, it's perhaps unfortunate that there was, for the issue was clouded for so many years by inadequate experimental data, which gave you very much exaggerated.
But the principles were okay if the right data had been put in, or some more adequate data.
Not necessarily, no. No, as I said, this down conversion process would operate just as well.
Okay.
We're going back to the assumption that we know everything.
Yes, right. The principles are right.
Now, I mean, why I brought up the changes in what we know about the universe is quite clear, even in the progress we've made in the last 30 years, that we don't know everything.
Yeah.
And there may be other factors. One is still up against... one is still up against quite a lot of difficulties, I think, in energy generation processes for some of these objects.
Oh, yeah.
On the assumption of any reasonable lifetime. Well, you can put your difficulties, you can say, well, we can invent some new physics to explain the energy generation, or we can invent some new physics to explain the redshift. And nobody can think of other getting the redshift, so. That appears to be the most difficult, so we leave the energy generation as a of the unknown.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
That ends the long interview with John Bolton on 15 March 78 at Parks.